So today we're going to be talking about goodness. So two weeks ago, when Caleb taught on gentleness, he gave you guys the breakdown. Do you guys remember how he broke the three? There's three groups of three. Do you guys remember how he broke it down?
Are you talking about,
I think so, whatever you said.
Minds, fruits of the Spirit?
Yeah.
Inward, outward.
Yep. So yeah, inward, so love, joy, and peace, those are inward things, inward emotions or feelings. And then the next three are outward, long-suffering, gentleness, goodness, that's things that you show to others. You're long-suffering, you're patient with people, you're gentle with them, which he talked about a couple weeks ago. And then today we're going to be talking about goodness. And then the last three, faith, meekness, and temperance, what are those? You have inward, you have outward, and you have... Yeah, what would that be called?
Faith.
No, that would fit in with what we're talking about. Inward, outward, and...
Upward.
Upward, there you go. Yeah, upward. Faith, meekness, and temperance. So those are things that we have towards God. So, yeah, I thought it was good to give you guys that breakdown. Maybe to help you remember the fruit of the Spirit. Maybe it'll help you with that. But also, it's just a good way to think about it as we're trying to apply these things. So, all of them are things that, apply to us. If we're walking in the Spirit and we're getting the fruit of the Spirit, we're going to get all of those things. But the way that they manifest themselves is inward, outward, and upward, depending on which of the ones we're talking about. So, so goodness in this passage is defined as virtue or beneficence. Anybody ever heard the word beneficence? Mm-hmm. I had never actually heard that word before. So beneficence is defined. You've heard that word before? Beneficence?
No, you said beneficence. I said banana.
Oh.
It's like beneficiary.
Beneficence.
Yeah. It is. I get where the word comes from. I just had never heard beneficence. Sounds like maleficence. I've heard of that one.
Oh, I've seen that movie. It's
movie. Anyways, so it's defined as actively doing good, showing kindness, acting in the best interest of others, often involving charity, mercy, or a moral obligation to benefit someone. So when you put that in context with what we're talking about with goodness, if it's going to be an outward showing of what God's doing in our life, if we're going to be long-suffering because God is working on us and helping us develop long-suffering to deal with other people that are difficult to deal with, if he's giving us gentleness, like Caleb last week was talking about at the end of his, or 2 weeks ago, at the end of his message, he was talking about the tongue and how we need to be careful of how we use our words and to be gentle to people when it comes to the things that come out of our mouth and the things that the actions that we do. So if we're going to try and live out that characteristic, and then goodness, if we're going to try and have that, and it's actively doing good. Okay, so that, in the context of being a Christian and in the context of trying to have fruit in our life to be good to other people, that seems fairly easy, or at least easy to understand. But showing kindness and acting in the best interest of others, that's counter to what our flesh wants. What does our flesh want? To act in the best benefit of who?
Us.
Yeah. It wants us to get what we want. It wants us to do what's best for us. It doesn't care about other people. And so this aspect of goodness manifesting itself as an outward showing of what God's doing on the inside of us towards others. Goodness is treating other people the way that we would want to be treated. Our church has a benevolence form. So going along with this beneficence word, we set aside money in the budget every year for benevolence. It's to help people that need a place to stay, or they need food, or they need a car repair, or they need whatever. Members of our church or just people in the community that call, and the pastors, look at each one of those requests that come in and they decide, is this something that we think is going to be something we should help with? Do we have the funds for this? Does anybody know this situation? Those kinds of things. But that's called benevolence. We're doing that so that we can, show kindness and mercy and, act towards our community and towards our membership, our body, with goodness to help them in times of need. So when we're talking about this particular passage, the word goodness, what is God talking about? How does that Why is that part of the fruit of the Spirit? The first time that the word goodness shows up in the Bible is in Exodus chapter 18. Turn to Exodus chapter 18. No. There's one eye above your head. Just reach up there. Oh, a little bit further back. It's going to be verse 9, but we're going to read a little bit bigger section. Huh?
I thought you said the verse.
No, I didn't say it yet. That's okay. So what's going on in the chapters right before Exodus 18? Exodus chapter 14. Anybody know what happens in Exodus 14? No. That was before that. That was like in 2, I think, or 1 or 2.
Wait, chapter 18 belongs?
Yeah. Huh?
Wait,
no. Yeah, what's the big thing that happens in chapter 14?
The Red Sea.
Oh. Yeah, the Red Sea. The parting of the Red Sea. They walk across on dry land, and then the waters, you know, crash onto Pharaoh and his army. Chapter 15, huh? Yeah, I guess so. Never heard that before. Chapter 15, the Israelites sing a song of rejoicing, and they talk about how God had delivered them, and they talk about, you know, how Pharaoh and his army were drowned in the sea, and so they have this time of celebration in the first half of chapter 15, and the second half of chapter 15, they get to this place, the first stop on their wilderness journey, and there's water there, but it's bitter water. And so the Israelites start complaining. They go to Moses and they're complaining about their water situation. And they're like, this is ridiculous. You brought us out here in the wilderness. There's not even any water. You know, like, what were we supposed to do? Right after they just got done seeing how God had delivered them, right after they had just walked through dry land at the parting of the Red Sea, they're complaining about not having fresh water. God fixes that for them, delivers them miraculously again, gives them fresh drinking water. Chapter 16, they come and complain to Moses about something else. Now they're complaining that they don't have any food. And they're on him about, man, when we were in Egypt, yeah, we were slaves, but at least we had food. At least we knew if we were going to die, we weren't going to die of starvation. And now you brought us out in the wilderness, and now you're just going to let us die of starvation? And it's like, dude, God has miraculously delivered you twice in the last, you know, few days. I mean, we're not talking like years have passed, huh? Yeah, I mean, it's like, I don't know if God's ever done something in your life before, and then like, it'd be like, you know, if you're praying about something, God gives you what you're praying for, delivers you from a situation, or, you know, helps you with whatever situation it is that you're dealing with, or just, you know, speaks to you through his word or whatever, he answers your prayer, and it'd be like waiting 30 seconds and then complaining because God's not doing anything in your life. And it's like, dude, he just did something. He literally just did something miraculous. In this case, he did two massive miracles in a row within a few days of each other. And now they're complaining about not having any food. So what does God do? Miraculously delivers them again with manna, right? He starts that daily, every morning delivery of manna. Just laying on the ground. They can just go pick it up as much as they want, whatever they're going to eat for that day. But they have to go gather it every day, of course. So he does another miraculous thing. Chapter 17. This time again, they face a lack of water. This time they don't have bitter water like they did in chapter 15. But now they're dealing with no water. And so God directs Moses to get water from a rock. And it's water enough to feed roughly 1 million people or more. And so, you know, God miraculously provides water again in the desert for them. And at the end of chapter 17, you guys remember the battle where they fight the Amalekites? And Joshua is the one leading the battle, and Moses is up on the hill, and when he holds his arms up, the Israelites are winning, and if his arms come down, then the Israelites start losing, and so he gets men to come by and hold up his arms, so he can hold up his arms long enough for them to get the victory. That's at the end of chapter 17. So again, now they're dealing with battle, and they're dealing with an actual enemy, and again, God miraculously delivers them. So they get to chapter 18, And like 18 verse 1 says, when Jethro, the priest of Midian, Moses' father-in-law, heard of all that God had done for Moses and for Israel, his people, and that the Lord had brought Israel out of Egypt, then Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took Zipporah, Moses' wife, after he had sent her back. Skip down to verse 7. And when Moses, so basically his father-in-law shows up and brings his wife and kids back to him. because they had been with him the whole time that Moses was doing the plagues in Egypt and freeing the people. He didn't want his wife and kids there, so they were with his father-in-law, so that he's bringing them back now that everything's kind of settled down. So verse 7, and Moses went out to meet his father-in-law and did obeisance and kissed him, and they asked each other of their welfare, and they came into the tent. And Moses told his father-in-law all that Pharaoh had done, or all that the Lord had done unto Pharaoh and to the Egyptians for Israel's sake, and all the travail that had come upon them by the way, and how the Lord delivered them. And Jethro rejoiced for all the goodness, there's the first time it shows up, which the Lord had done to Israel, whom he had delivered out of the hand of the Egyptians. And Jethro said, blessed be the Lord, who hath delivered you out of the hand of the Egyptians, and out of the hand of Pharaoh, who hath delivered the people from under the hand of the Egyptians. Now I know that the Lord is greater than all gods, for in the thing wherein they dealt proudly, he was above them. Okay, so he meets up with them, and they meet, and they kind of do their pleasantries, and they go into the tent, and Moses tells his father-in-law all the things that have been happening, and all the things that God has done. First he says, in verse 8, he says, that the Lord had done, the first thing is unto Pharaoh. So what had God done unto Pharaoh that Moses is telling his father-in-law about? What did God do unto Pharaoh that Moses might be telling his father-in-law about? He says that he told his father-in-law all that the Lord had done unto Pharaoh.
Or the Red
Sea,
killing
the sun, killing the sun's right, yeah. All the plagues. Yep. Gave Moses and Aaron, I mean, Jethro, his father-in-law, he worked with him for 40 years. So he had 40 years where he lived as an Egyptian, and then he killed the guy, and he ran off, and he goes and gets married, and works for Jethro for 40 years. So when he's 80, that's when he goes back, and frees the people. So Jethro knows him pretty well. So when he tells Jethro, hey, I went and stood before the king of Egypt, and I, you know, was bold and proclaimed all these things to him, right? Might have been a little bit surprising for Jethro to hear, like, man, I thought you couldn't speak well, like all those things that Moses had a problem with, reasons why he told God he couldn't go. So he tells him all these things that God did unto Pharaoh. Then it says, and to the Egyptians. So what did he do to the Egyptians? Same thing, right? All the plagues. I don't know if you guys know this or not, but some of the plagues affected both the Israelites and the Egyptians. Some of the plagues only affected the Egyptians, right? So sometimes, you know, the Egyptians are getting hit with, I can't remember which ones off the top of my head, but let's say they have, you know, frogs all over the place. And in the Israelite area of town, there's no frogs, right? God keeps them separate from that. You know, or whichever ones, I don't remember. I didn't look up which ones was which, but I think about half of them affected both, huh? I don't remember which was all of them, but anyways, that, you know, that's going to cause some problems, obviously, culturally, like, you know, these guys are getting affected by it while the Israelites are not. So he tells about how God delivered them, the things he did unto Pharaoh, the things he did to the Egyptians, and then it says after that, and all the travail that had come upon them by the way, and how the Lord had delivered them. And so all the travail that had come upon them by the way, that's Moses telling his father-in-law about all these things, probably. Man, you should have seen it. The Red Sea, you know, this was amazing how God delivered us. And then, you know, these people started griping and complaining the very next day about the water. And you wouldn't believe, God, you know, delivered it. He gave us, you know, fresh water. And then, you know, he's going through all this list of things. We don't have, you know, all the list of things that he went through. But all the travail that had come upon them, by the way, that's, you know, all the other things that has happened to them. And all the things that God did. And then Jethro's response is that he rejoiced for all the goodness which the Lord had done. And so I don't know if you guys, like, look at it from Moses' perspective, right? I'm guessing he's telling him he's excited about all the things that God did to Pharaoh, all the things that God did to the Egyptians. My guess is, this is my speculation, it doesn't say this in the Bible, I'm just, as a man, I'm just thinking, like, how would I have felt about these things? When he's talking about all the travail that had come upon them, the leader, Moses is the leader, right? He doesn't probably get to complain a lot. Like, he's the one who takes all the complaining from everybody. He spends 40 years listening to these people whine and complain about every single little thing that goes wrong. He deals with it all. He has patience with them. He's long-suffering, for sure. But, you know, this is his father-in-law. This is his family. You know, it's a little bit different than talking to, you know, some of the Israelites or some of his other leaders. You know, I'm guessing he probably is like, man, these people, that dad, father-in-law, I don't, what am I supposed to do with these people? These people are ridiculous. Like, God has done these amazing things, and, you know, all they want to do is complain because they don't have water or food. Like, what am I supposed to do about that? You know, like, I'm thinking these are some of the things. So I'm guessing as he's telling, you know, his father-in-law about this, and then his father-in-law rejoices for all the goodness. You know, sometimes it's easy to get caught up in, I don't know if Moses looked at it as all goodness. Of course, the delivering from Egypt and all that, the miracles that God did, but, you know, sometimes when you're in the midst of, even when God's doing some things, and you're in the midst of it, it can still feel like, man, you know, I don't know, like some of this stuff just kind of sucks, you know, it kind of sucks that we're, you know, we're wandering in the wilderness and, you know, we're having to, every single day we're having to go out and get all this food and all this stuff. But Jethro's like excited for him because of God showing all this goodness to him. And so I thought that was kind of interesting, you know, that we don't always look at goodness in our own life as goodness. Sometimes we miss some of the things that God's doing because we're focused on we didn't get exactly what we wanted, or we didn't get it exactly how we thought it was going to go, or when we thought we would get it. And so, you know, we get kind of frustrated with things, but it takes his father-in-law to come in and be excited for him and to be like, man, God has been so good to you guys. And then maybe at that moment, Moses might have been like, oh yeah, you know, like God has been really good to us. I was frustrated with these people, and, you know, we know Moses deals with a lot of complaining, but, you know, sometimes it takes like an outside person, to step in and be like, man, God's been really good to you. God has really blessed you. When you're in the midst of, you know, just your head's down and you're just plowing forward, it's not always easy to recognize those things. But somebody else comes along and points it out. Hey, God's been really good to you. You know, that happens in our life sometimes too. All right, verse 9. And Jethro rejoiced for all the goodness which the Lord had done to Israel, whom he had delivered out of the hand of the Egyptians. And so it wasn't Moses' goodness either that Jethro was praising. It wasn't Moses' goodness that got them out of those different things. It was the goodness of the Lord being shown to Moses and being shown to the Israelites. And so when we're talking about the fruit of the Spirit, and we're talking about, you know, how can we be long-suffering towards people that are difficult, right? Moses had to deal with that. How do we be gentle with people? Moses had to deal with that also. The one time he messes up and he's not gentle with them and he hits the rock, what does God do? He takes away the blessing that he was going to get by being able to enter into the promised land. And so we need to be very careful about the things that we say and the things that we do. And I don't want to reteach that, what Caleb taught a couple weeks ago. But you know, if we're going to be talking about God's goodness and how does that come through our life, it's only by the fruit of the Spirit. It's only by the fact that God is in us and doing things through us that we're able to treat people with goodness and show the goodness of God to others. We can't do that on our own. In us is nothing good, right? The Bible tells us that, you know, our righteousness, the best thing that we can do is as filthy rags, right? It tells us that there's none good, no, not one. Like, we don't have goodness within ourselves. Now, we can be kind to other people, you know, without the Lord, but the best thing that we can do, you know, the best good thing that we can do pales in comparison to God's goodness. And we only get that through the fruit of the Spirit. So when we speak and we act, is it the goodness of God that's on display? Or is it, you know, are we trying to do good on our own? I used to work in customer service jobs. I had several different customer service jobs that I worked in. And, you know, that kind of a environment where you're working customer service, you're dealing with people, even not just difficult people, just you're working as a cashier or you're working as a, you know, like a bank teller. I did that. You know, you work in these different customer service environments. And, you know, if you have good training, you know, they teach you how to deal with difficult people or how to be kind to people, even when they're, you know, angry or whatever, you know, to try to de-escalate the situation. But if we're a Christian, we should have those kinds of skills. We should, as we get more of the fruit of the Spirit, as we allow God to have more control over our life, we should be able to more easily interact with people that are difficult, you know, and change the tone of that conversation. You know, goodness is being, having the goodness of the fruit of the Spirit is about, you know, being kind to people even when they don't deserve it. Like, that's an easy thing to say, but a really hard thing to do. You know, most of us are not naturally, you know, desiring to deal with difficult people. And when we do deal with difficult people, our natural inclination is to, like, you know, they, you know, rise up against us and we're going to get right back up again, you know, get in their face or, you know, match their tone, or we're going to try to, you know, get one, you know, one, we want the last word, we want the final jab, we want to, you know, when they walk away, we want to say something under our breath, or we want to turn to our coworker or to our friend that's with us or whatever, and, you know, and talk bad about that person. I do all those same things, guys. I'm not saying, that, you know, that I'm perfect in that area, but that, those are our natural inclinations. And, you know, when we're in a church setting like this, it's easy to say, well, yeah, I mean, we can show goodness and kindness to other people in this room or in that room or in this building out here. Like, it's pretty easy to do those things when, you know, everybody's got a smile on their face and they're greeting you when you walk in the door, and, you know, there's food and there's places to sit, and, you know, you can sit with people that you want to, and everybody's nice, and, you know, nobody's fighting and yelling and screaming at each other. It's easy to be chill and show goodness in those situations. But it's when we face difficult times or difficult people that we have an opportunity to show how God has changed us from the inside out. So those inward things, the love, joy, and peace, when we have those things inside, those things are going to show themselves outward through, you know, long-suffering, gentleness, and goodness toward other people. We're going to be able to show people what God has been doing on the inside that they can't see. God, you can't see the goodness of God in my life if I just sit and don't talk and don't act and never interact with you. Like, I can't show God's goodness to you until I'm put in a difficult situation, or until, you know, somebody comes at me with an attitude of some kind, and I'm able to talk to that person and diffuse the situation and love on that person and be kind to that person, even when that's not the way that they're approaching me. You don't get to show off goodness in easy situations. When you're at church on a Sunday morning, it's hard to show people the goodness of God in your life because everybody's acting nice and kind to one another. It's whenever you have to face, you know, opposition or difficulty or, you know, some other kind of situation that that's where you really get a chance to show the goodness of God. If you take kindness and goodness of God, and you take that out into the world, like outside of this church building, it stands out. Maybe you guys think of any examples of maybe times that God has given you an opportunity to witness some goodness in the world, or times that you yourself have been in a situation like that, or can you just think of like positive things? I mean, things that stand out in a world that's of difficult people. Like, you guys probably see reels and stuff like that where, you know, someone's yelling and screaming and fighting in a grocery store or something like that. They're kind of fun to watch because people are just, like, going crazy. But then you see other times where people are doing that, and the other person on the other end is just, like, they're calm, they're quiet, they're chill. And you watch the difference between those two people. And it's almost comical to watch people freak out whenever the other person is showing calmness and goodness. I'm not saying it's even goodness of the Lord. It's just, you know, they're not engaging with what the person's doing. But have you guys, any of you guys ever experienced anything like that, or have any examples or times that that's happened in your lives? Put you on the spot. Nobody? Huh? Probably. So this an example that came up this week in my own life. This guy came to the church, I won't go into all the details of his situation, but he stopped by the church looking for help, looking for benevolence, right? And so, working in the office, I'm the one who primarily takes those requests. Either people come in, usually people call, but this guy stopped in. He was in a bad home situation. He was living with somebody. They threatened him. He's got a couple young kids, or he's got an 11-year-old and then a younger kid. And they don't have a place to stay, and, you know, he's almost in tears, like just in the sanctuary or in the foyer of the church. And, you know, I sat down with him, just talked to him, just listened to his situation, trying to find out what's going on with him. And, you know, we were able to help him with a couple nights in a hotel just to give him a place to stay and kind of get things, maybe allow things to calm down a little bit. You know, that's just meeting his physical needs. He needed a place to stay. He needed like a calmer place for, you know, a couple days to get away with his family. And so, you know, I didn't provide that personally, but like the church, was able to provide that for this guy. Just something like that, you know, and that was meeting a physical need, not even a spiritual need. That wasn't me showing, you know, the goodness of God in a spiritual way. Although I did say, hey, this is not a, you know, requirement for us to help you, but you know, you need hope. You need some, you know, like this is a church. Like we would love to have you here. You don't have to come for us to help you. Like that wasn't, you know, trying to, you know, manipulate him in that way. But I, you know, I invited him to come in and I was like, you know, this is a great place to just have some, you know, calm and some love and some hope in your life. And so maybe he'll come, maybe he won't. I don't know. But that just happened. I think it was, I don't know, sometime this week, one of the days this week. One of my go-to things for thinking about this kind of stuff, you guys have probably experienced. How many of you guys have been to Chick-fil-A? Yeah, it's like the best chicken restaurant in the world. Not because they have the best chicken. They have good chicken, but what stands out about Chick-fil-A?
Some nice
the sauce.
Service.
Yeah, they have nice people, the service.
You must get nice people.
They always have nice people. Every Chick-fil-A I've ever been to, except for, we went to one in Texas, they got our order wrong, it took them forever, they were not super friendly people. But that was one exception. I've been to tons of Chick-fil-A's. They stand out because they pride themselves on good customer service. They go out of their way to be like ridiculously kind. You know, huh?
I like Zaxby's better.
I don't like the chicken better than every other chicken place. Zaxby's has really good chicken. Popeye's chicken sandwich is better than Chick-fil-A's chicken sandwich. But you go to Chick-fil-A because the service is so great. They meet you in the drive-thru. They'll take your order. It's fast. It's going to be the same pretty much every time. You don't have to worry about all those kinds of things. But they stand out because they're kind. They train their employees to be, you know, kind. They train their employees to, you know, go above and beyond. What is what the customer wants? And let's do more than what the customer even asks for, right? They're over the top on their kindness. So that's like an easy one. And they're a Christian organization. They're not a, you know, they wouldn't necessarily align doctrinally with us, but they're a Christian organization, you know, and they try to show that. They try to show that through the way that they do, things. Any of you guys know a guy named Jesse Cole? The name sound familiar to any of you guys?
Jesse Larkin.
Not Jesse Larkin, Jesse Cole.
Another guy too.
Nobody knows Jesse Cole? Any of you guys know who the Savannah Bananas are? So Jesse Cole is the guy in the yellow suit that owns the Savannah Bananas. And, I saw an interview with him, it's probably been 2 or 3 weeks ago. It was like an hour and a little over an hour long interview where he was sitting down with this guy and he was just talking to him about the history of the Savannah Bananas, how they started. And he was talking more about it from like an entrepreneurial standpoint where, you know, he was just talking about things that they've done in their organization that's worked and how they've become such a huge, success. Seemingly overnight, even though it hasn't been overnight. I think their first game was like in 2016, you know, but like most of you guys probably started hearing about them within the last couple of years, maybe when they started getting really, really big. But anyway, he was talking about a lot of different things, but the name of the company that owns the Savannah Bananas is called Fan First Entertainment. And so he was talking about how they named their company Fan First Entertainment because their goal is to put what the fan wants above everything else. They go out of their way, over the top, to give the fans a good experience. And so he's talking about when they first started out, when they were a lot smaller, every week after the game was over, they would call every single fan that came to the game to thank them for coming to the game, to ask them about their experience, to ask if there's anything they could do better, if there's anything that the fan didn't like, those kinds of things. They can't do that anymore because they're selling out, like, they could sell out Arrowhead Stadium tomorrow if they played there. So you can't call 80,000 people. But they used to call every single fan every single week to see how they liked it. He still to this day goes to the upper deck of every stadium that they go play at. And he takes pictures. He signs autographs. He just, like, engages with the fans who are in the upper level, you know, that maybe are forgotten about by some people because they're, you know, they're far away. You can't see as good, all those kinds of things. But he goes up and engages with those people. He said one of their coaches, maybe their head coach, I don't know, used to write a letter. He'd write like 50 or 100 letters, and he would go stick them underneath the seats of several different seats in the upper deck just to thank people for coming and tell them that, they, you know, he hopes they enjoy the game and all those kinds of things. You know, most of the time when they go to a new city, they'll bring a celebrity out from that city. I was watching some highlights last night. They had John Cena come out one time, and they had, you guys seen The Sandlot?
Yeah.
They brought out Ham from The Sandlot, and he took an at-bat in the game. Like, he was playing, huh? He was playing for the team. Just fun things like that, like things that are nostalgic, things that they think people will like. They do all the trick plays. They have different rules than regular baseball. They do all these things, and they do all of that because they want to stand out above the competition. And right now, I mean, if you want tickets to a Savannah Bananas game, you got to get into a lottery, and if you don't win that, then you can buy them on the secondary market. But they're selling for, I mean, to get upper-level seats to a Savannah Bananas game is like $200-$300 a piece at least. And they're selling out, I mean, they are selling out Major League Baseball stadiums all over the place. I mean, we can't sell out the Royal Stadium. Like, other than opening day, the Royal Stadium is not sold out. But they sold it out, like, super fast. I mean, because they played there maybe this summer, or it was recently. And they sell it out. They sell out football stadiums. They're going all over the place. They're expanding their team because that one team can't travel, you know, to all these different cities where people want them to come. So now they're adding more new teams. So the league is getting bigger. The Banana Ball League is getting bigger. All this stuff, just listening to him talk and the mindset that he has. Again, he's not, I don't know if he's a Christian or not. So he's not coming at it trying to show the goodness of God, but he's doing things different than any other professional sports league has ever done. Right? You go to Royals game or a Chiefs game or whatever. You know, Lamar Hunt is not engaging with Chiefs fans in the stadium. He's not walking around the upper deck thanking people for coming. You know, Patrick Mahomes is not out there doing backflips on the field, and, you know, they're not bringing in, you know, celebrities to come take a few snaps with the team. Like, they're not engaging the fans. Now, I'm not saying that the Chiefs are not engaging their fans. They are, but it's in a different way. And so, you know, while some of these other sports, baseball is kind of dying in popularity. The popularity keeps going down every year, not just in Kansas City, but, you know, just Major League Baseball-wide. Popularity is going down, and they're trying to save their fans and bring people back and all these kinds of things. And Banana Ball, a very similar game, is exploding. Everybody wants to watch it. It's because they put the fans first, because they're looking to make it a good experience for the fan. And, you know, through that, more and more people are watching their content. More and more people are subscribing to their stuff. More and more people are trying to come to the games. Those kinds of things. And so I say all that to say, again, he's not a spiritual, he's not doing things spiritually minded. But we can take those examples and we can see, okay, when somebody does something that is dramatically different than what everybody else is doing, people take notice of that, right? At the very least, you're going to know that there's something different about it. If you act differently and you say things differently and you deal with, you know, teachers who are annoying or kids who are annoying or, you know, kids who are trying to mess with you, or you deal with, you know, failure, in your academic life or difficult situations in your home life or whatever, when you deal with those things with a different level of grace, and you deal with those things with a different level, you know, of processing those things, people will notice that about you. When your words aren't the same as everybody else's words, people will notice that about you. The goodness of God can show forth. That doesn't happen overnight. It doesn't happen by accident. It happens because you're intentionally walking in the Spirit on a daily basis, and eventually, over time, that will start to come out in your life. And turn to Psalms chapter 51. We're going to wrap up with Psalm 51. Huh? It is. That's it. So I was just going to read one of the verses in this chapter, but I was reading the chapter last night and I was like, well, you know, everybody knows Psalm 51:10. Create in me a clean heart, O God, and renew a right spirit within me. That is the song that we sing here at church sometimes. But I started reading the whole chapter just to kind of get a sense of what was going on. As we're talking about God's goodness, I just thought it'd be good to read the whole chapter. So I'm going to read it. I'll just make a few comments along the way. Have mercy upon me, O God, according to thy loving kindness, according unto the multitude of thy tender mercies, blot out my transgressions. Okay, so real fast, I should have started with this. Your Bible may or may not have, at the beginning, right before verse 1, It says, to the chief musician, a psalm of David, when Nathan the prophet came unto him after he had gone into Bathsheba. I don't know how many of you guys' Bible say that, but this is a psalm that David wrote right after, remember when Nathan came to him, and he tells him the story about the rich man, and there was this poor guy, he had one lamb, and the rich man had tons of them, and he had a friend come in from out of town, and he went to the poor man, took his lamb, sacrificed it, served it to this guy. And David was like, man, find who this guy is. You know, he's got to fix the situation. He's got to, you know, give this guy back more than he lost and all this stuff. And then Nathan says, thou art the man. And it was like one of those convicting moments where he's like, dude, you're the guy. You have access to everything you could ever want. And Uriah had his wife and you killed the guy and took his wife. And so this was the psalm that he wrote right after that. And so he's saying, have mercy upon me, O God. David just did the biggest sin of his whole life. And he murdered a guy. And so when he's singing this song, singing this song to the Lord, have mercy upon me, O God, according to thy loving kindness, according unto the multitude of thy tender mercies, blot out my transgressions. Wash me thoroughly from mine iniquity, and cleanse me from my sin. For I acknowledge my transgressions, and my sin is ever before me. He's not hiding from it. He's not, you know, trying to sweep it under the rug. He's praying. He's like pleading with God to have mercy on him, because he knows he messed up. Verse number 4. Against thee only have I sinned, and done this evil in thy sight, that thou mayest be justified when thou speakest, and be clear when thou judgest. Behold, I was shapen in iniquity, and in sin did my mother conceive me. Behold, thou desirest truth in the inward parts, and in the hidden part thou shalt make me to know wisdom. Purge me with hyssop, and I shall be clean. Wash me, and I shall be whiter than snow. Make me to hear joy and gladness, that the bones which thou hast broken may rejoice. Hide thy face from my sins, and blot out all mine iniquities. Create in me a clean heart, O God, and renew a right spirit within me. Cast me not away from thy presence, and take not thy Holy Spirit from me. Now, we can't lose our Holy Spirit in the New Testament, so that verse doesn't directly apply to us. But sometimes it can feel like that, like, you know, God, don't leave me or forsake me. Don't abandon me. Even though we know God can't do that, when we're in, you know, a really bad situation, sometimes it feels like that. Because it makes sense that, you know, that he would leave, even though he won't. Verse 12, restore unto me the joy of thy salvation, and uphold me with thy free spirit. He's like, man, God, please, you know, wash me from this sin that I've done. Forgive me. Have mercy on me. All these things. But restore unto me the joy of thy salvation. There's joy that comes with salvation. Even in the New Testament, especially the New Testament, when God saves somebody, there's joy. The Bible says that, you know, that there's joy in heaven over one sinner that repenteth. And so, you know, he's like, man, restore unto me the joy of thy salvation. That's one of the fruit of the Spirit too. Verse 13, then will I teach transgressors thy ways, and sinners shall be converted unto thee. God, if you can show some mercy to me and restore me back to how I was, I'll never stop telling other people about it. Right? There will be other people that will be converted unto thee because of what you've done in my life. That should be the mindset of a Christian. We should be seeking that. Because God has restored the joy unto us through salvation. Verse 14, deliver me from blood guiltiness, O God, thou God of my salvation. And my tongue shall sing aloud of thy righteousness. God, I'm going to sing it from the mountaintops if you let me. Verse 15, O Lord, open thou my lips, and my mouth shall show forth thy praise. For thou desirest not sacrifice, else would I give it. Thou delightest not in burnt offering. The sacrifices of God are a broken spirit, a broken and a contrite heart, O God, thou wilt not despise. Do good in thy good pleasure unto Zion. Build thou the walls of Jerusalem, then shalt thou be pleased with the sacrifices of righteousness, with burnt offering and whole burnt offering. Then shall they offer bullocks upon thine altar. So those last few verses, talking about doing good in thy good pleasure. The goodness of God should show forth in our life because he's been so good to us. That's what he's telling us in the last half of this chapter. He's like, man, God, if you could just, you know, just please have mercy on me. Don't take your Holy Spirit from me. Restore the joy that I once had, and I'll tell everybody else about it. Okay, that's where we find ourselves. If you're saved, if you're born again, you have the Holy Spirit of God living inside of you. You have the joy that comes with that salvation. And when you walk in the Spirit and you spend time with God and reading His Bible through prayer, through fellowship with other Christians, all of those things, the goodness of God should flow out of us. We should be able to reach others with that message because he reached us with that message to begin with.